local tribute from District 11 had died of natural causes. Sadly, that meant they wouldn't be seeing much more of Felix Ravenstill.
Lepidus, can we have a few last words with him from Heavensby Hall?
Lepidus pulled Felix out and asked him how he felt about having to leave the games.
Well, it isn't a shock, really. The girl was on her last legs when she got here, said Felix.
I think it's enormously to your credit that you got her through the interview, said Lepidus sympathetically. Many mentors didn't manage even that.
Coriolanus wondered if Lepidus's high praise had more to do with Felix's being the grandnephew of the president than anything else, but he didn't begrudge it. It set a precedent for a level of success that he'd already surpassed. So even if Lucy Gray didn't last the night, he could still be viewed as a standout. But she must last the night, and then another, until she won. He had promised to help her, but so far he'd done absolutely nothing except promote her to the audience. Back in the studio, Lucky heaped a few more compliments on Felix and signed off.
As night falls on the arena, most of our tributes have bedded down, and so should you. We'll keep an eye on things here, but we don't really expect much action until morning. Pleasant dreams!
The game makers cut to a wide shot of the arena, where the silhouette of Lamina on her beam was about all Coriolanus could make out. After dark, the arena had no lighting except what the moon provided, and that usually didn't make for good viewing. Dean Highbottom said they might as well go home, although bringing a toothbrush and a change of clothes for the future would be a good idea. They all shook hands with Felix and congratulated him on a job well done, and most of them meant it, as the day had cemented the mentor bond in a brand new way. They were members of a special club that would dwindle down to one, but always define them all. As he walked home, Coriolanus did the math. Two more tributes were dead, but he'd stopped counting Marcus as a contender a while back. Still, only 13 left, and only 12 competitors that Lucy Gray needed to survive. And as Dill and the asthmatic boy from District 5 had proven, a lot of it could come down to a matter of her simply outliving the others. He thought back to yesterday, wiping away her tears, the promise to keep her alive, the kiss. Was she thinking of him now? Was she missing him the way he was missing her? He hoped she would make an appearance tomorrow and he could get her some food and water, remind the audience of her existence. He'd only had a few new gifts in the afternoon, and that might have been due to her alliance with Jessup. Lucy Gray's charming songbird persona was becoming less impressive with each grim moment in the Hunger Games. No one knew about the rat poison but him, so that didn't help her standing. Hot and tired from the stressful day, he wanted nothing more than to shower and sink into bed. But the moment he stepped into the apartment, the fragrance of the jasmine tea reserved for company wafted over him. Who would be visiting at this hour? And on opening day at that? It was far too late for the grand mam's friends, far too late for neighbors to be dropping in, and they weren't the dropping in kind anyway. Something must be wrong. The Snows rarely used the television in the formal living room, but of course they had one. Its screen showed the darkened arena, just as he'd left it at Heavensby Hall. The grandmam, who'd pulled a decent robe over her nightdress, perched stiffly on a straight-backed chair at the tea table while Tigress poured out a steaming cup of pale liquid for their guest. For there sat Mrs. Plinth, frumpier than ever, her hair disheveled and her dress awry, crying into a handkerchief.
"You're such nice people," she sputtered. "I'm so sorry to have dropped in on you like this."
"Any friend of Coriolanus is a friend of us all," said the grand mam. "Plinch, did you say?"
Coriolanus knew she knew exactly who Ma was, but to be forced to entertain anyone, let alone a plinth, at this hour challenged everything she stood for.
"Plinth," said the woman, "plinth.
You know, grandmam, she sent the lovely casserole when Coriolanus was injured," Tigress reminded her.
"I'm sorry, it's too late," said Mrs. Plinth.
Please, don't apologize. You did exactly the right thing, said Tigris, patting her shoulder.
She spotted Coriolanus and looked relieved.
Oh, here's my cousin now. Perhaps he knows something.
Mrs. Plinth, what an unexpected pleasure. Is everything all right? Coriolanus asked, as if she wasn't dripping with bad news.
Oh, Coriolanus, it isn't. Not at all. Sejanus hasn't come home. We heard he left the academy this morning, and I haven't seen him since. I'm so worried, she said. Where can he be?
I know Marcus being like that hit him hard. Do you know where he could be? Was he upset when he left?
Coriolanus remembered that Sejanus's outburst, the throwing of the chair, the shouting of insults, had been confined to the audience in Heavensby Hall. He was upset, ma'am, but I don't know that it's any cause for worry. He probably just needed to blow off some steam. Took a long walk or something. I'd do the same thing myself.
But it's so late. It isn't like him to up and disappear, not without letting his ma know, she fretted.
Is there anywhere you can think of he might go? Or somebody he might visit? Asked Tigris.
Mrs. Plinth shook her head.
No. No, your cousin's his only friend.
How sad, thought Coriolanus, to have no friends. But he only said, you know, if he'd wanted company, I think he'd have come to me first. You can see how he might have needed some time alone to make sense of all this. I'm sure he's all right. Otherwise you'd have heard of it.
Did you check with the peacekeepers? Asked Tigris.
Mrs. Plinth nodded.
No sign of him.
You see, said Coriolanus, there's been no trouble. Maybe he's even home by now.
Perhaps you should go and check, suggested the Grand Mam a little too obviously.
Tigris shot her a look.
Or you could just call.
But Mrs. Plinth had calmed down enough to take the hint.
No, your grandma's right. Home is the place I should be, and I should let you all get to bed.
Coriolanus will walk you, said Tigris firmly.
As she left him no choice, he nodded.
Of course.
My car is waiting down the block.
Mrs. Plinth rose and patted her hair down.
Thank you. You've all been so kind. Thank you.
She'd gathered up her voluminous handbag and was starting to turn when something on the screen caught her eye. She froze. Coriolanus followed her gaze and saw a shadowy shape slip out of the barricade and cross toward Lamina. The figure was tall, male, and carrying something in his hands. Reaper or Tanner, he thought. The boy stopped when he reached Marcus's corpse and looked up at the sleeping girl. I guess one of the tributes finally decided to make a move on her. He knew he should watch as a mentor, but he really wanted to get rid of Mrs. Plinth first. Shall I walk you to your car? He asked. I bet you'll find Sejanus in bed.
No, Coriolanus, said Mrs. Plinth in a hushed voice. No.
She nodded at the screen.
My boy's right there.
Chapter 15. The moment Ma said it, Coriolanus knew she was right. Perhaps only a mother would make the connection in that gloom, but with her prompting, he recognized Sejanus. Something about the posture, the slight stoop, the line of the forehead. The white academy uniform shirt glowed faintly in the dark, and he could almost make out the bright yellow mentor badge still hanging by the lanyard on his chest. How Sejanus had gotten into the arena, he had no idea. A capital boy, a mentor no less, might not have drawn too much attention at the entrance, where you could buy fried dough and pink lemonade, where you could join the crowd watching the games on the screen. Had he merely blended in? Or even used his minor celebrity to set suspicions at bay? My tribute's finished, so I may as well enjoy myself? Posed for pictures? Chatted up the peacekeepers and slipped in somehow while their backs were turned? Who would think he'd want to enter the arena, and why on earth had he? On screen, a shadowy Sejanus knelt, set down a parcel, and rolled Marcus onto his back. He did his best to straighten the legs, to fold the arms on the chest, but the limbs had grown stiff and defied arrangement. Coriolanus couldn't tell what was happening next. Something with the parcel, but then Sejanus rose to his feet and held his hand over the body. That's what he did at the zoo, thought Coriolanus. He remembered when, after Arachne's death, he'd caught a glimpse of Sejanus sprinkling something over the dead tribute's body.
"That's your son in there. What's he doing?" asked the grandmam, aghast.
"He's putting breadcrumbs on the body," said Ma, "so Marcus has food on his journey."
"His journey where?" asked the grandmam. "He's dead."
"Back to wherever he came from," said Ma. "It's what we do back home when someone dies."
Coriolanus couldn't help feeling embarrassed for her. If you ever needed proof of the district's backwardness, there you had it. Primitive people with their primitive customs. How much bread had they wasted with this nonsense?
"Oh no, he starved to death. Somebody get the bread."
He had a sinking feeling that his supposed friendship was going to come back to haunt him. As if on cue, the phone rang.
"Is the whole city up?"
wondered the grandmam.
"Excuse me." Coriolanus crossed to the phone in the foyer. "Hello?" he said into the receiver, hoping it was a wrong number.
"Mr. Snow, it's Dr. Gall."
Coriolanus felt his insides contract.
"Are you near a screen?"
"Just got home, actually," he answered, trying to buy time.
"Oh, yes, there it is. My family's watching." "What's going on with your friend?" she asked.
Coriolanus turned his head away from the gathering and lowered his voice.
"He's not really that." "Nonsense! You've been thick as thieves," she said. "Help me give away my sandwiches, Coriolanus. Empty seat next to me, Sejanus. When I asked Casca what classmates he was close to, yours was the only name he could think of."
His civility to Sejanus had obviously been misread. Really, they were hardly more than acquaintances. "Dr. Gall, if you'd let me explain—"
"I don't have time for explanations. Right now, the plinth brat's loose in the arena with a pack of wolves. If they see him, they'll kill him on the spot."
She turned to speak to someone else.
"No, don't cut away abruptly. That will only draw attention. Just make it as dark as you can. Make it look natural. A slow blackout, as if a cloud has drifted over the moon."
She was back in the next breath.
"You're a smart boy. What message will that send to the audience? The damage will be considerable. We must remedy the situation at once."
"You could send in some peacekeepers," Coriolanus said.
"And have him bolt like a rabbit?" she scoffed. "Imagine that for a moment. The peacekeepers trying to chase him down in the dark. No, we'll have to lure him out as uneventfully as possible. So we'll need people he cares about. He can't stand his father, no siblings, no other friends. That leaves you and his mother. We're trying to locate her now."
Coriolanus felt his heart sink. "She's right here," he admitted. So much for his acquaintance's defense.
"Well, done and done. I want you both here at the arena in 20 minutes. More, and it will be me serving you with a demerit, not Highbottom, and you can kiss any chance of a prize goodbye."
With that, she hung up. On his television, Coriolanus could see that the image had darkened. He could barely make out Sejanus' figure at all now. Mrs. Plinth, that was the head game maker. She'd like you to meet her at the arena to collect Sejanus, and I'm to accompany you. He could hardly admit to more without giving the grandmam a heart attack.
"Is he in trouble?" she asked, wide-eyed. "With the capital?"
Coriolanus found it strange that she'd be more worried about the capital than an arena full of armed tributes at this point, but maybe she had reason after what had happened to Marcus. "Oh no, they're just concerned with his well-being. Shouldn't be long, but don't wait up," he told Tigris and the grandmam. As fast as he could, short of carrying her, he moved Mrs. Plinth out the door, down the elevator, and through the lobby. Her car rolled up soundlessly, and the driver, most likely an Avox, only nodded at his request to be taken to the arena. "We're rather in a hurry," Coriolanus told the driver, and the car sped up immediately, gliding through the empty streets. If it was possible to cover the distance in 20 minutes, they would. Mrs. Plinth clutched her handbag and stared out the window at the deserted city.
"First time I saw the capital, it was night like this."
"Oh, yes," said Coriolanus, only to be polite. Honestly, who cared? His entire future was on the line because of her wayward son, and one had to question the parenting of a boy who thought breaking into the arena would solve anything.
Sejanus sat right where you are, saying, "It'll be all right, Ma, it'll be okay," trying to calm me down, when we both knew it was a disaster, said Mrs. Plinth. But he was so brave, so good, only thinking of his Ma.
Must have been a big change. What was it with the Plinths, anyway? To be constantly turning advantage to tragedy. You needed only to take a cursory glance at the interior of this car, the tooled leather, the upholstered seats, the bar with its crystal bottles of gem-colored liquids, to know they were among the most fortunate people in Pan Am.
"Family and friends cut us off," Mrs. Plinth went on. "No new ones to be made here. Strabo, his pa, that is, still thinks it was the right thing to do. No kind of future in two. His way of protecting us. His way of keeping Sejanus from the games."
Ironic, really, given the circumstances. Coriolanus tried to redirect her. "Now, I don't know what Dr. Gall has in mind, but I imagine she wants your help getting him out of there."
"I don't know if I can," she said. "Him so upset and all. I can try, but he'll have to think it's the right thing to do."
The right thing to do. Coriolanus realized that this was what had always defined Sejanus' actions, his determination to do the right thing. That insistence, the way, for instance, he would defy Dr. Gall when the rest of them were just trying to get by, was another reason he alienated people. Frankly, he could be insufferable with those superior little comments of his, but playing on that might be the way to manipulate him. As the car pulled up to the entrance of the arena, Coriolanus saw an effort had been made to conceal the crisis. Only a dozen or so peacekeepers were present, and a handful of game makers. The refreshment booths had shut down, the day's crowd had dispersed earlier, so there was little to draw curious spectators. Stepping out, he noticed how quickly the temperature had dropped since his walk home. In the back of a van, a Capital News monitor displayed a split screen with the actual feed of the arena next to the darkened version going out to the public. Dr. Gall, Dean Highbottom, and a few peacekeepers were gathered around it. As Coriolanus walked up with Mrs. Plinth, he made out Sejanus kneeling next to Marcus's body, still as a statue.
"At least you're punctual," said Dr. Gall. "Mrs. Plinth, I presume?"
"Yes, yes," said Mrs. Plinth, a quaver in her voice. "I'm sorry if Sejanus has caused any inconvenience. He's a good boy, really. It's just he takes things so to heart."
"No one could accuse him of being indifferent,"
Dr. Gall agreed. She turned to Coriolanus.
"Any idea how we might rescue your best friend, Mr. Snow?"
Coriolanus ignored the barb and examined the screen. "What's he doing?"
"Just kneeling there, looks like," said Dean Highbottom. "Possibly in some kind of shock."
"He appears calm. Perhaps you could send the peacekeepers in now without startling him," suggested Coriolanus.
"Too risky," said Dr. Gall.
"What about putting his mother on a speaker or a bullhorn?" Coriolanus continued. "If you can darken the screen, surely you can manipulate the audio as well."
"On the broadcast, but in the arena, we'd alert every tribute to the fact that there's an unarmed Capital boy in their midst," said Dean Highbottom.
Coriolanus began to get a bad feeling. "What do you propose?"
"We think someone he knows needs to slip in as unobtrusively as possible and coax him out," said Dr. Gall. "Namely, you."
"Oh, no," burst out Mrs. Plinth with surprising sharpness. "It can't be Coriolanus. The last thing we need is to put another child in danger. I'll do it."
Coriolanus appreciated the offer, but knew the chances of this were slim. With her red swollen eyes and wobbly high heels, she did not inspire confidence as a covert operator.
What we need is someone who can make a run for it, if necessary. Mr. Snow is the man for the job.
Dr. Gall gestured to some peacekeepers, and Coriolanus found himself being suited up in body armor for the arena.
This vest should protect your vital organs. Here's your pepper spray, and a flash unit that will temporarily blind your enemies, should you make any.
He looked at the small bottle of pepper spray and the flash unit. What about a gun, or at least a knife?
Since you're not trained, this seems safer. Remember, you're not in there to do damage. You're in there to bring your friend out as quickly and quietly as possible, instructed Dr. Gall.
Another student, or even the Coriolanus of a couple of weeks ago, would have protested this situation, insisted on calling a parent or guardian, pleaded. But after the snake attack on Clemencia, the aftermath of the bombing, and Marcus's torture, he knew it would be pointless. If Dr. Gall decided he was to go into the Capitol Arena, that's where he would go, even if his prize was not at stake. He was just like the subjects of her other experiments, students or tributes, of no more consequence than the Avoxes in the cages, powerless to object.
You can't do this. He's just a boy. Let me call my husband, begged Mrs. Plinth.
Dean Highbottom gave Coriolanus a little smile. He'll be all right. It takes a lot to kill a Snow.
Had this whole idea been the Dean's? Had he seen a neat shortcut to his ultimate goal of destroying Coriolanus's future?
At any rate, he seemed deaf to Ma's entreaties. With peacekeepers at either elbow, for his safety, or to prevent him from bolting, he crossed to the arena. He had little recollection of being carried out after the bombing. Perhaps they'd gone out another exit, but now he could see the significant damage to the main entrance. One of the two great doors had been entirely blown away, leaving a wide hole framed with twisted metal. Besides the guard, little had been done to secure this area other than placing a few rows of waist-high concrete barriers across the opening. Sejanus wouldn't have had much trouble getting past those if there'd been a decent distraction, and there'd been the bustle of a carnival most of the day. If the peacekeepers had been concerned about rebel activity, they would have been focused on someone targeting the crowd. Still, it seemed a little too relaxed. What if the tributes tried to make a break for it again? Coriolanus and his escort wove their way through the barriers and into the lobby, which had taken multiple hits. The few unbroken electric bulbs around the admission and concession booths showed a layer of plastered dust coating chunks of ceiling and floor, toppled pillars and fallen beams. To reach the turnstiles required navigating the debris, and again he could see how Sejanus might have crossed it undetected, with a little patience and a bit of luck. The turnstiles on the far right side had been targeted, leaving gnarled, melted metal shards and open access. Here, the peacekeepers had built the first real fortification, installing a temporary set of bars encased in barbed wire, and a half-dozen armed guards. The undamaged turnstiles were still an effective blockade, as they did not allow re-entry.
So he had a token? Asked Coriolanus.
He had a token, confirmed an old peacekeeper who seemed to be in command.
Caught us off guard. We're not really looking for people breaking into the arena during the games, only out.
He produced a token from his pocket.
This one's for you.
Coriolanus turned the disc in his fingers but made no move to the turnstiles.
How did he think he'd get out?
I don't think he did, said the peacekeeper.
And how will I get out? Asked Coriolanus.
This plan seemed dicey at best.
There.
The peacekeeper pointed to the bars. We can pull back the barbed wire and tilt the bars forward, creating an opening big enough for you to crawl under.
You can do that quickly? He said doubtfully.
We've got you on camera. We'll start moving the bars when you're successfully bringing him out, the peacekeeper assured him.
And if I can't convince him to come? Coriolanus asked.
We have no instructions on that, the peacekeeper shrugged. I guess you stay until the mission is accomplished.
A cold sweat bathed Coriolanus's body as the words registered.
He would not be allowed back out without Sejanus. He looked through the turnstile to the end of the passage, where the barricade had been erected under the scoreboard, the one he'd seen Lamina, Cirque, and Tesley scampering in and out of earlier in the games. What about that? That's for show, really. It blocks the view of the lobby, of the street. Can't put that on camera, the peacekeeper explained. But you won't have trouble getting through it. Then neither would the tributes, Coriolanus thought. He ran his thumb over the slick surface of the token. We've got you covered up to the barricade, the peacekeeper said. So you'll kill any tribute to attack me, Coriolanus clarified. Scare them off anyway, said the peacekeeper. Don't worry, we've got your back. Excellent, said Coriolanus, not at all convinced. He steeled himself and jammed the token in the slot. Then he pushed the metal arms. Enjoy the show, the turnstile reminded him, sounding 10 times louder in the stillness of the night. One of the peacekeepers chuckled. Coriolanus made for the wall on the right and walked forward as swiftly and silently as he could. The red emergency lights, his only illumination, suffused the passageway with a soft, bloody glow. He pressed his lips tightly together, controlling his breathing through his nose. Right, left, right, left. Nothing. No one stirred. Perhaps, as Lucky had suggested, the tributes had all bedded down for the night? He paused for a moment at the barricade, just as the peacekeeper had said it was a sham. Flimsy layers of barbed wire mounted on frames, rickety wooden structures and concrete slabs arranged to block the view, not imprison the tributes. Probably hadn't been enough time for a real one, or perhaps it had been deemed unnecessary with the bars and peacekeepers behind him. As it was, he had only to wind his way through the backdrop to find himself at the edge of the field. He hesitated behind a final stretch of barbed wire, surveying the scene. The moon had risen high in the sky, and in the pale, silvery light he could make out the figure of Sejanus, back toward him, still kneeling over Marcus's body. Lamina hadn't stirred. Other than that, the immediate area seemed deserted. Was it, though? The wreckage from the bombings provided ample hiding places. The other tributes could be concealed a few yards away, and he'd never know it. In the chilly air, his sweat-soaked shirt felt clammy against his skin, and he wished for his jacket. He thought of Lucy Gray in her sleeveless dress. Had she curled up against Jessup for warmth? The image didn't sit well with him, so he pushed it away. He could not think of her now, only of the present danger, and Sejanus, and how to get him to the other side of that turnstile. Coriolanus took a deep breath and stepped out onto the field. He padded across the dirt, channeling the circus wildcats he had seen here as a boy. Fearless and powerful and silent. He knew he must not spook Sejanus, but he needed to get close enough to converse. When he was 10 feet behind him, he stopped and spoke in a hushed voice. Sejanus? It's me. Sejanus stiffened. Then his shoulders began to shake. At first, Coriolanus took it for sobbing, but it was quite the opposite. You really can't stop rescuing me, can you? Coriolanus joined in the laughter under his breath. Can't do it. They sent you in to fish me out? What madness! Sejanus's laughter trailed off and he rose to his feet. Did you ever see a dead body? A lot. During the war. He took it as an invitation to join Sejanus and closed in. There. He could grab his arm now. But what then? It was unlikely he could drag him from the arena. He shoved his hands into his pockets instead. I haven't so much. Not this close. At funerals, I guess, and at the zoo the other night, only those girls hadn't been dead long enough to stiffen up, Sejanus said. I don't know if I'd rather be burned or buried. Not that it matters, really. Well, you don't have to decide now. Coriolanus's eyes swept the field.
Was that a person in the shadows behind the broken wall? Oh, it won't be up to me, said Sejanus. I don't know what's taking the tribute so long to find me. I must have been in here a while. He looked at Coriolanus for the first time, and his brow wrinkled in concern. You should go, you know?
I'd like to, Coriolanus said carefully. I really would. Only there's the matter of your ma. She's waiting out front, pretty upset. I promised I'd bring you to her.
Sejanus's expression turned indescribably sad. Poor ma. Poor old ma. She never wanted any of this, you know? Not the money, not the move, not the fancy clothes or the driver. She just wanted to stay in too, but my father...
But he isn't here, is he?
No. He'll keep his distance until this is settled. Then let the buying begin.
Buying what?
The breeze ruffled Coriolanus's hair and made hollow, echoing sounds in the arena.
This was taking too long, and Sejanus was making no effort to speak softly.
Buying everything. He bought our way here, bought my schooling, bought my mentorship, and he goes nuts because he can't buy me, said Sejanus. He'll buy you if you let him, or at least compensate you for trying to help me.
Buy away, thought Coriolanus, thinking of next year's tuition. He only said, you're my friend. He doesn't need to pay me to help you.
Sejanus laid a hand on his shoulder. You're the only reason I've lasted this long, Coriolanus. I need to stop causing you trouble.
I didn't realize how bad this was for you. I should have traded tributes when you asked, he answered.
Sejanus sighed. It doesn't matter anymore. Nothing does, really.
Of course it matters, Coriolanus insisted.
They were coming now, he could feel it. The sense of a pack closing in on him.
Come out with me.
No. There's no point, said Sejanus. There's nothing left to do but die.
Coriolanus pressed him. That's it? That's your only choice?
It's the only way I might possibly make a statement. Let the world see me die in protest, Sejanus concluded. Even if I'm not truly capital, I'm not district either. Like Lucy Gray, but without the talent.
Do you really think they'll show this?
They'll quietly remove your body and say you died of the flu.
Coriolanus stopped, wondering if he'd said too much, if it pointed too directly at Clemencia's fate. But it wasn't as if Dr. Gall and Dean Highbottom could hear him.
They've all but blacked out the screen now.
Sejanus' face clouded over.
They won't show it?
Not in a million years. You'll be dead for nothing, and you'll have wasted your chance to make things better.
A cough, small and muffled, but definitely a cough, coming from the stands to his right.
Coriolanus had not imagined it.
What chance? Asked Sejanus. You have money.
Maybe not now, but one day you'll have a fortune. Money has a lot of uses.
Look how it changed your world. Maybe you could make changes too, good ones. Maybe if you don't, a lot more people will suffer.
Coriolanus's right hand tightened around his pepper spray, then flitted to his flash unit. Which would actually help if he was attacked?
What makes you think I could do that? Said Sejanus. You're the only one who had the guts to stand up to Dr. Gall, said Coriolanus.
He hated giving that to him, but it was true. He was the sole member of the class who'd defied her.
Thank you.
Sejanus sounded tired, but a bit saner.
Thank you for that.
Coriolanus put his free hand on Sejanus's arm, as if comforting him, but really trying to grip his shirt if he decided to run.
We're being surrounded. I'm going. Come with me.
He could see Sejanus starting to cave. Please, what do you want to do, fight the tributes or fight for them? Don't give Dr. Gall the satisfaction of beating you. Don't give up.
Sejanus stared down at Marcus for a long moment, weighing his options.
You're right, he said finally. If I believe what I say, it's my responsibility to take her down, to end this whole atrocity somehow.
He lifted his head, as if suddenly realizing their situation. His eyes turned toward the stands where Coriolanus had heard the cough. "But I won't leave Marcus." Coriolanus made a snap judgment. "I'll get his feet." The legs were stiff and heavy, reeking of blood and filth, but he crooked the knees in his arms as best he could and hoisted Marcus's lower half. Sejanus encircled his chest with his arms, and they began to move, half carrying, half dragging the body toward the barricade. 10 yards. 5 yards. Not far now. Once they'd cleared it, the peacekeepers should provide some cover. He tripped on a rock and went down, driving his knee into something sharp and piercing, but sprang back up, heaving Marcus's body with him. Almost there. Almost. The footsteps came from behind him. Quick and light, speeding from the barricade where the tribute had lain in wait. Coriolanus reflexively dropped Marcus and spun around just in time to see Bobbin bring down his knife.
Chapter 16. The blade glanced off his body armor and sliced his left upper arm. As Coriolanus leaped backward, he swung at Bobbin but only encountered air. He landed in a pile of debris, old boards, and plaster as his hand searched for some kind of defense. Bobbin sprang at him again, aiming the knife at his face. Coriolanus's fingers closed around a 2x4, and he brought it up, catching Bobbin in the temple hard, sending him to his knees. And then he was on his feet, using the board like a club, bringing it down again and again without being sure where it made contact. "We have to go!" Sejanus shouted. Coriolanus could hear catcalls now, and feet pounding down the bleachers. Confused, he made a move toward Marcus's body, but Sejanus yanked him away. "No! Leave him! Run!" Needing no persuasion, Coriolanus sprinted for the barricade. Pain shot from his elbow to his shoulder, but he ignored it,
pumping his arms as hard as he could,
the way Professor Sickle had taught them. When he reached the barricade, barbed wire bit into his shirt, and as he turned to pull it free, he saw them. The 2 tributes from District 4, Coral and Mizzen, and Tanner, the slaughterhouse kid, making straight for him, armed to the teeth. Mizzen drew his arm back to throw a trident. The fabric on Coriolanus's sleeve ripped wide as he yanked it from the barbed wire and dove out of the line of fire, with Sejanus right behind him. Only a few weak rays of moonlight penetrated the layers of the barricade, and Coriolanus found himself crashing into wood and fencing like a wild bird in a cage, surely alerting any tribute who'd somehow missed his presence. He ran face first into a concrete slab, and Sejanus plowed into him from behind, smacking his forehead into the unrelenting surface a second time. When he pushed back, it was as if the concussion had never left. His head throbbed, and a cloud of confusion descended. The tributes started up a whooping sound, rattling their weapons against the barricade as they tracked the mentors through the labyrinth. Which direction to go? The tributes seemed to be all around them. Sejanus grabbed his arm and began to pull him, and he stumbled blindly along behind, wounded and terrified. Was this it, then? Was this how he died? The fury at the injustice of it all, the mockery it made of his existence, sent a surge of energy through him, and he crashed past Sejanus, finding himself on his hands and knees in a cloud of soft red light. The passageway. Up ahead he could make out the turnstiles, where the peacekeepers were clustered at the temporary bars. He ran for his life. The passageway wasn't long, but it seemed interminable. His legs rose and fell as if he were waist-high in glue, and black specks dotted his vision. Sejanus stayed steady at his elbow, but he could hear the tributes gaining. Something heavy and unyielding, a brick, clipped the side of his neck. Another object punctured his vest and stuck, bobbing behind him until it fell with a clank. Where was the cover? The protective gunfire from the peacekeepers? There was nothing. Nothing at all. And the bars still stood flush with the floor. He wanted to scream for them to kill the tributes, shoot them dead in their tracks, but his breath was in too short supply. Someone heavy-footed shrank his lead to a few yards. But once again, remembering Professor Sickle's training, he didn't dare waste a second looking back to see who it was. Before him, the peacekeepers finally managed to tilt the unit of bars inward, achieving a gap of about 12 inches at the ground. Coriolanus dove, sanding several layers of skin off his chin on the rough floor, and just getting his hands beneath the bars where the peacekeepers latched onto him and gave a great yank. Lacking time to turn his head, the rest of his face scraped against the filthy surface until he reached safety. The guards dumped him immediately to retrieve Sejanus, who gave a sharp cry as Tanner's knife cut open the back of his calf before he slid out of range. The bars were slammed into place, and bolts locked down the unit, but the tributes were undeterred. Tanner, Mizzen, and Coral jabbed their weapons through the bars at Coriolanus and Sejanus, spewing hate-filled taunts while the peacekeepers banged on the turnstiles with their batons. Not a shot was fired, not even a shot of pepper spray. Coriolanus realized that they must have been under orders to leave the tributes untouched. As the peacekeepers helped him to his feet, he spat out in rage. "Thanks for having our backs! Just following orders. Don't blame us if Gaul thinks you're expendable, boy," said the old peacekeeper who'd promised him cover. Someone tried to steady him, but he shoved them off. "I can walk. I can walk, no thanks to you." Then he listed sideways, almost hitting the floor before they hoisted him up again and made their way back through the lobby. Coriolanus babbled a long string of profanities, which made no impression, and hung in their grip like dead weight until they dropped him, unceremoniously, just outside the arena. After a minute, they deposited Sejanus beside him. They both lay panting on the tiles that graced the front of the arena.
"I'm so sorry, Corio," said Sejanus. "I'm so sorry."
Corio was a nickname for old friends, for family, for people Coriolanus loved, and this was the moment Sejanus decided to try it out? If he'd had the energy, Coriolanus would have reached over and strangled him. No one paid them any attention. Ma had vanished. Dr. Gall and Dean Highbottom debated audio levels as they watched the feeds in the van. The peacekeepers stood in loose clumps, waiting for instructions. 5 minutes passed before an ambulance drove up and popped open its back doors. The boys were loaded in without so much as a glance from the authorities. The medic gave Coriolanus a pad to hold against his arm wound while she dealt with the more pressing issue of Sejanus's calf, which was producing quite a bit of blood. Coriolanus dreaded returning to the hospital and that untrustworthy Dr. Wayne until he saw through the small pane of glass that they'd arrived at the Citadel, which seemed twice as scary. Unloaded onto gurneys, they were swiftly transported deep down to the lab where Clemencia had been attacked, leaving Coriolanus to wonder just what modifications they had in store for him. Accidents must have been frequent in the lab, as a small medical clinic awaited them. It had lacked the sophistication for Clemencia's resurrection, yet seemed adequate to patch up the boys. A white curtain divided their two hospital beds, but Coriolanus could hear Sejanus giving one-word answers to the doctor's inquiries. He gave little more himself as they stitched his arm and cleaned his raw face. His head ached, but he didn't dare tell them about the rebound of his concussion for fear he'd end up being admitted to the hospital for an indefinite stay. All he wanted was to get away from these people. Despite his protests, they stuck an IV in his arm to rehydrate him and deliver some cocktail of drugs, and he lay rigid on the bed, willing himself not to flee. Although he'd done Dr. Gall's bidding, although he'd succeeded, he felt more vulnerable than ever. And here he lay, wounded and trapped, hidden away in her lair. The pain eased in his arm, but he did not feel the velvet curtain of morphling draw around him. Some alternative drug must have been administered, because, if anything, his mind felt a heightened sharpness, and he noticed everything, from the weave of the bedsheet to the tug of the tape on his raw skin, to the bitter taste the metal cup of water left on his tongue. Peacekeeper boots approached and withdrew, taking a limping Sejanus with them. Deep in the lab, A round of squeals heralded some creature's feeding time, and the faint scent of fish reached him. After that, a relative hush fell over the place for a long time. He considered trying to slip away, but knew in his heart he was expected to wait. To wait for the soft slipper tread that inevitably made its way to his cubicle. When Dr. Gall pulled back the curtain, the twilight of the nocturnal lab gave Coriolanus the strange impression that she stood on the edge of a cliff, that if he were to give her even the smallest shove, she would topple backward into some great chasm, never to be heard from again. If only, he thought. If only. Instead, she moved forward and placed two fingers on his wrist, checking his pulse. He flinched at the feel of her cool, papery fingers.
I started out as a medical doctor, you know, she said. Obstetrics.
How awful, Coriolanus thought, to have you be the first person in the world a baby sees.
Wasn't really for me, said Dr. Gall. Parents always want reassurances you can't give about the futures their children face. How could I possibly know what they'd encounter? Like you, tonight. Who would have imagined Crassus Snow's darling baby boy fighting for his life in the Capitol arena? Not him, for one.
Coriolanus didn't know how to respond. He could barely remember his father, let alone divine his imaginings.
What was it like? In the arena?
Asked Dr. Gall. Terrifying, said Coriolanus flatly.
It's designed to be.
She checked his pupils, shining a light into each of his eyes.
What about the tributes?
The light hurt his head. What about them? Dr. Gall moved on to his stitches.
What did you think of them now that their chains have been removed? Now that they've tried to kill you? Because it was of no benefit to them, your death. You're not the competition.
It was true. They'd been close enough to recognize him, but they'd hunted down him and Sejanus. Sejanus, who'd treated the tributes so well, fed them, defended them, given them last rites, even though they could have used that opportunity to kill one another. I think I underestimated how much they hate us, said Coriolanus.
And when you realized that, what was your response?
She asked. He thought back to Bobbin, to the escape, to the tribute's bloodlust even after he'd cleared the bars. I wanted them dead. I wanted every one of them dead. Dr. Gall nodded.
Well, mission accomplished with that little one from 8. You beat him to a pulp. Have to make up some story for that buffoon Flickerman to tell in the morning. But what a wonderful opportunity for you. Transformative.
Was it? Coriolanus remembered the sickening thuds of his board against Bobbin. So he had what? Murdered the boy? No, not that. It was an open and shut case of self-defense. But what then? He had killed him, certainly. There would never be any erasing that. No regaining that innocence. He had taken human life.
Wasn't it? More than I could have hoped. I needed you to get Sejanus out of the arena, of course, but I wanted you to taste that as well,
she said. Even if it killed me? Asked Coriolanus.
Without the threat of death, it wouldn't have been much of a lesson, said Dr. Gall. What happened in the arena? That's humanity undressed. The tributes, and you too, how quickly civilization disappears. All your fine manners, education, family background, everything you pride yourself on, stripped away in the blink of an eye, revealing everything you actually are. A boy with a club who beats another boy to death. That's mankind in its natural state.
The idea laid out as such shocked him, but he attempted a laugh.
Are we really as bad as all that?
I would say yes, absolutely. But it's a matter of personal opinion.
Dr. Gall pulled a roll of gauze from the pocket of her lab coat.
What do you think?
I think I wouldn't have beaten anyone to death if you hadn't stuck me in that arena. he retorted.
You can blame it on the circumstances, the environment, but you made the choices you made, no one else. It's a lot to take in all at once, but it's essential that you make an effort to answer that question. Who are human beings? Because who we are determines the type of governing we need. Later on, I hope you can reflect and be honest with yourself about what you learned tonight.
Dr. Gall began to wrap his wound in gauze.
And a few stitches in your arm is a cheap price to pay for it.
Coriolanus felt nauseous at her words, but even more enraged that she had forced him to kill for the sake of her lesson. Something that significant should have been his decision, not hers. No one's but his. So if I'm a vicious animal, then who are you? You're the teacher who sent her student to beat another boy to death.
Oh, yes. That role has fallen to me.
She neatly finished the bandage off.
You know, Dean Highbottom and I read your essay through. What you liked about the war? A lot of fluff. Drivel, really. Until that bit in the end. The part about control. For your next assignment, I'd like you to elaborate on that. The value of control, on what happens without it. Take your time with it. But it might be a nice addition to your prize application.
Coriolanus knew what happened without control. He'd seen it recently, at the zoo when Arachne died, in the arena when the bombs went off, and then again tonight. Chaos happens. What else is there to say?
Oh, a good deal, I think. Start with that. Chaos. No control. No law. No government at all. Like being in the arena. Where do we go from there? What sort of agreement is necessary if we're to live in peace? What sort of social contract is required for survival?
She removed the drip from his arm.
We'll need you back in a couple of days to check those stitches. Until then, I would keep the night's events to yourself. Better get home and catch a few hours of sleep. Remarkably, your tribute still needs you.
After she left, Coriolanus slowly pulled on his sliced, torn, bloody shirt and fastened the buttons. He wandered until he found the elevator to street level, and the disinterested guards waved him out. The trolleys ended at midnight, and the Capitol clock showed 2, so he pointed his filthy shoes toward home. The plinth's luxurious car slid up beside him, and the window lowered to reveal the Avox, who stepped out and opened the back door for him. Coriolanus guessed he'd already taken Sejanus home, and Ma had sent him back. Since the car was empty of plinths, he got in. One last ride, then he wanted nothing to do with that family ever again. When the driver let him out at his apartment, Coriolanus was presented with a large paper bag. Before he could object, the car pulled away. Upstairs, he peeked in to see Tigress waiting by the tea table, wrapped in a ratty fur coat that had been her mother's. It was her security blanket, much as the rose powder compact had been his before he revamped it as a weapon. He grabbed a school jacket from the coat rack and pulled it over his damaged shirt before he went in to see her. Coriolanus tried to make light of the dreadful night. Surely it's not so bad you need the coat. Her fingers dug into the fur.
You tell me.
I will, every bit of it. But in the morning, okay? He said.
Okay.
When she reached up to hug him goodnight, her hand felt the bulge of the bandage on his arm. Before he could stop her, she pulled back the jacket and saw the blood. She bit her lip.
Oh, Corio. They made you go into the arena, didn't they?
He hugged her. Not that bad, really. I'm here. Got Sejanus out, too.
Not that bad? It's horrific to think of you in there, to think of anyone in there,
she cried.
Poor Lucy Gray.
Lucy Gray. Now that he'd been in the arena himself, her circumstances seemed even more dire than before. The thought of her huddled somewhere in the cold blackness of the arena, too petrified to close her eyes, made him ache. For the first time, he felt glad he'd killed Bobbin. At least he'd saved her from that animal. It's going to be okay, Tigris. But you have to let me get some rest. You need to sleep too. She nodded, but he knew she'd be lucky to snatch an hour or two. He handed her the bag. Courtesy of Ma Plinth. Breakfast, by the smell of it. See you then. Not bothering to bathe, he collapsed into a comatose sleep until the sound of the grandmam singing the anthem woke him. Time to be getting up anyway. Aching head to toe, he teetered to the shower, removed the gauze from his arm, and let the hot water scream over his scraped flesh. He had a tube of ointment from his time in the hospital, and although unsure of its use, dabbed it on his raw face and chin. The stitches on his arm snagged on his clean shirt, but no new bleeding appeared. He'd wear his jacket today just in case. Throwing a toothbrush and fresh uniform in his book bag, he took one last look in the mirror and sighed. Bicycle accident, he thought. That's the story. Not that I've had a working bicycle in years. Well, now he had an excuse for its broken condition. Once he was presentable, the first thing he did was check the television to make sure no harm had come to Lucy Gray. But the camera hadn't shifted, and the only tribute visible in the early morning light was lamina on her beam. Avoiding the grandmam, he came into the kitchen, where Tigris was warming up the leftover jasmine tea. Running late, he said. I better get going. Take this for breakfast. She put a packet in his hands and placed a pair of tokens in his pocket. And take the trolley today. Needing to conserve energy, he did as he was told, riding the trolley and eating two loaded egg and sausage rolls Mrs. Plinth had sent over. His only regret about ditching the Plinths would be the loss of her cooking. The main student body had been told to report at 7:45, so the early birds consisted of the active mentors and a few AVOXes tidying the hall. Coriolanus couldn't help throwing a guilty look at Juno Phipps, who sat discussing her strategy with Demetia when she could have slept in. He didn't much like her. She was always throwing her family lineage in his face as if his wasn't as good. But last night hadn't been fair to her either. He wondered how they would reveal Bobbin's death and how he would feel when they did, besides queasy. The only thing being served at Heavensby Hall was tea, which brought grumblings from Festus. If we have to be here early, you'd think they could at least feed us. What happened to your face? Bike accident, Coriolanus said, loud enough for everyone to hear.
He tossed the bag with the last roll to Festus, happy to be able to offer food for a change.
He owed the Creeds more meals than he cared to remember. Thanks. This looks great, said Festus, digging in immediately. Lysistrata recommended a cream to prevent infection, and they went ahead and took their seats as their schoolmates began to arrive. Although the sun had been up for a few hours, nothing much appeared changed on the screen except the disappearance of Marcus's body.
I guess they removed it, said Pup.
But Coriolanus thought it might still be by the barricade where he and Sejanus had abandoned it last night, just out of range of the shot. At the stroke of 8, they all rose for the anthem, which his classmates finally seemed to be getting a handle on. And then Lucky Flickerman appeared, welcoming them to day 2 of the Hunger Games.
While you were sleeping, something pretty important happened. Let's take a look, shall we?
They cut back to the wide shot of the arena, and then slowly panned the camera round to the barricade, zooming in. As Coriolanus had suspected, Marcus's body lay where he and Sejanus had dropped it. A few feet away, Bobbin's battered form slumped against a chunk of concrete. It looked much, much worse than he'd imagined. The bloody limbs, the dislodged eye, the face so swollen it was unrecognizable. Had he really done that to another boy? And such a young boy, too. For in death, Bobbin looked tinier than ever. Lost in that dark web of terror, it seemed he had. Perspiration beaded Coriolanus's forehead, and he wanted to leave the hall, the building, the entire event behind. But of course, that wasn't an option. Who was he? Sejanus? After a good long look at the bodies, the show cut back to Lucky as he pondered who might have done the deed. Then his mood changed abruptly.
One thing we do know is that we've got something to celebrate!
Confetti fell from the ceiling, and Lucky blew madly away on a plastic horn.
Because we've just hit the halfway mark! That's right, 12 tributes down and only 12 to go!
A string of brightly colored handkerchiefs shot out of his hand. He swung it around his head, dancing and cheering.
Woo-wee!
When he finally wound down, he adopted a sad expression.
But that also means we've got to say our farewells to Miss Juno Phipps. Lepidus?
Lepidus had already positioned himself at the end of the unsuspecting Juno's aisle, and she had no choice but to join him and work through her disappointment on camera. Given a little notice, Coriolanus imagined she'd have comported herself more graciously, but as it was, she came off as sour and suspicious, questioning the recent developments as she flashed a leather binder inlaid with the Phipps family crest.
Something seems fishy to me, she told Lepidus. I mean, what's he doing over there with Marcus's body? Who moved it? And how did Bobbin end up dead? I can't even imagine a likely scenario. I feel like there might have been foul play.
The reporter sounded genuinely puzzled.
What would qualify as foul play, exactly? I mean, in the arena. Well, I don't know, exactly, steamed Juno, but I, for one, would really like to see a replay of last night's events.
Good luck with that, Juno, thought Coriolanus. Then he realized it did exist. In the back of the van, Dr. Gall and Dean Highbottom had been watching both versions, the real feed and the one they'd darkened to obscure his mission. Even the regular one would be hard to make out. Still, he didn't like it. The idea that somewhere there was a record, however shadowy, of him killing Bobbin. If it were ever to get out, well, he didn't know what. But it made him uneasy. Lepidus didn't dally with Juno, a sore loser who lacked Felix's grace in defeat, and she was directed back to her seat with a consoling pat on the back. Still sparkly with confetti, Lucky seemed oblivious to her pain. He leaned in toward the camera with barely contained glee. And now what do you suppose? We've got an extra big surprise, especially if you're one of the 12 remaining mentors. Coriolanus only had a moment to exchange questioning looks with his friends before Lucky bounded across the studio to reveal Sejanus sitting side by side with his father, Strabo Plinth, whose stern expression seemed carved from the very granite of his home district. Lucky took the host chair and patted Sejanus on the leg.
Sejanus, I'm sorry we didn't get a moment with you yesterday to let you comment on the demise of your tribute, Marcus.
Sejanus just stared at Lucky uncomprehendingly. Lucky seemed to notice the abrasions on his face for the first time.
What's going on here? You look like you've been mixing it up yourself.
I fell off my bike, Sejanus rasped,
and Coriolanus winced slightly. Two biking mishaps in the same 12-hour period seemed more than coincidental.
Ouch! Well, I guess you have some pretty big news to share with us, Lucky said with an encouraging nod.
Sejanus lowered his eyes for a moment, and while neither father nor son acknowledged each other, a battle seemed to be occurring.
Yes, Sejanus finally began. We, the Plinth family, would like to announce that we will be giving a prize for a full ride to the university to the mentor whose tribute wins the Hunger Games.
Pop let out a whoop, and the other mentors grinned at one another. Coriolanus knew most of them didn't need the money as badly as he did, if at all, but it would be a feather in anyone's cap.
Sensational, said Lucky. What a thrill those 12 remaining mentors must be experiencing right now. Was this your idea, Strabo, to create the Plinth Prize?
My son's, actually, said Strabo,
curving the edges of his lips up in what Coriolanus thought might be an attempt at a smile.
Well, what a generous and appropriate gesture, especially given Sejanus's defeat. You may not have won the games, but you've certainly taken home the prize for good sportsmanship. I think I speak for the capital when I say many thanks.
Lucky beamed at the pair. but as nothing else was forthcoming, he made a sweeping gesture with his arm. All right then, back to the arena! Coriolanus's mind reeled with the new development. Sejanus had been right about his father's hasty attempt to bury his son's outrageous behavior in cash. Not that it didn't merit damage control. He hadn't heard much reaction from the others in Heavensby Hall about the outburst with the chair, but he expected stories were going around. A prize for the victor's mentor seemed a small price to pay, really. What would Plinth offer to prevent word of Sejanus's trip into the arena from going public? Could he be planning to buy Coriolanus's silence? Never mind, never mind that, Coriolanus told himself. The bigger news was the possibility of winning the Plinth Prize. It was independent of the Academy, so Dean Highbottom wouldn't have a say in it. Even Dr. Gall would not. A full ride that would free him from their power and lift this awful anxiety about the future from his shoulders. Already high, the stakes of these games shot into the stratosphere. Focus, he told himself, drawing slow, deep breaths. Focus on helping Lucy Gray. What was there to do, though, until she showed her face? As the morning passed, it seemed few of the tributes were tempted to do so. Coral and Mizzen roamed around together for a bit, collecting food and water from Festus and Persephone, their mentors. They'd been spending time together trying to come up with a joint strategy for their tributes, and Coriolanus could see that Festus was falling for her. Did you tell your best friend his crush was a cannibal? Never a rule book when you needed one. When they returned to the dais after lunch, they found the mentor seats had been reduced to 12, leaving only enough space for those with tributes still in the games. The game makers requested it, Soteria told the final dozen. It makes it easier for the audience to keep track of who's still a contender. We're to keep removing seats as your tributes are killed.
Like musical chairs,
said Demetia with a pleased look. But with people dying, said Lysistrata. The decision to bump the losers from the dais made Livia even more bitter, if that was possible, and Coriolanus was glad to see her relegated to the regular audience section, where he wouldn't have to hear her snarky comments. On the other hand, it made it harder to put distance between himself and Clemencia, who seemed to spend all her free time glaring at him. He positioned himself in the last row, bolstered by Festus and Lysistrata, and tried to look engaged. As the afternoon unrolled, his head got heavier and heavier, until Lysistrata had to nudge him twice to keep him awake. Perhaps it was fortunate the day required so little of him, given that the night had almost killed him. There were few tribute sightings, and Lucy Gray stayed completely hidden. Not until the late afternoon did the Hunger Games finally present the kind of action that people expected. The girl tribute from District 5, a rickety little thing who had been one of the unwashed herd to Coriolanus, made her way out onto the bleachers at the far end of the arena. Failing to find her name, Lucky just managed to connect her with her equally forgettable mentor, Iphigenia Moss, whose father oversaw the agriculture department, and thus the flow of food around Panem. Contrary to expectations, Iphigenia always seemed on the verge of malnutrition, often giving her school lunch to her classmates and even blacking out on occasion. Clemencia had once told Coriolanus it was the only revenge she could take on her father, but refused to give any more details. True to form, Iphigenia began to unload every bit of food she could on her tribute. But even as the drones made the long trek across the arena, Mizzen, Coral, and Tanner, who appeared to have formed some sort of pack after the previous night's adventure, materialized from the tunnels and began their hunt. After a brief chase along the bleachers, the trio surrounded the girl, and Coral killed her with a trident to the throat.
"Well, that's that," said Lucky, still unable to locate the tribute's name. "What can her mentor tell us, Lepidus?"
Iphigenia had already sought out Lepidus.
"Her name was Sol, or maybe Sal. She had a funny accent. Not much more to tell."
Lepidus seemed inclined to agree. "Nice job getting her to the second half, Albina."
"Iphigenia,"
said Iphigenia over her shoulder as she walked off the dais. "That's right,"
said Lepidus. And this means there's only 11 tributes left.